Examination C2. Section 1, Listening. I am going to give you the instructions for this part of the test. You will hear this sound at the start of each piece. Remember to transfer your answers to the optical mark form before the end of the exam. Now open your question paper and look at Part 1, Section A. Listening, Part 1, Section A. Listen to Anne Thomas, a radio presenter, and historian Professor Richard James, talking about women in the world of science. For questions 1 to 5, choose the correct answer A, B, or C. You will hear Section A twice. You have 1 minute to read the questions for Section A. Part 1, Section A. Hello to all our listeners. If someone asked you to produce a list of famous scientists and mathematicians, you might include the names of Archimedes, Isaac Newton, and Albert Einstein. All great men, certainly. But where are the great women on your list? Marie Curie, discoverer of radium and winner of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, might spring to mind. But can she be the only woman ever to have achieved fame in the world of science? Our guest today is Professor Richard James, an expert on the history of science, and he's going to shed some light on this question. So, Richard, where are the women scientists and mathematicians? Do they actually exist?
Yes, Anne, they've always existed. And the recent upsurge of interest in the apparent gender imbalance in most areas of endeavour throughout history has led academics to reappraise the accomplishments of women in the scientific sphere, despite the barriers and prejudices they faced.
Well, it's certainly good to know Marie Curie wasn't alone. How far back can we go in our search for female scientists?
A surprisingly long way. In the field of medicine, we have records of an Egyptian woman called Merit Ptah, who lived over 4,000 years ago and was described as chief physician. So Merit Ptah is the original female scientist. We also know of women scientists in ancient Greece. There was Aglionike, who predicted eclipses of the sun and moon, and Theano, who was a pupil and possibly also the wife of Pythagoras.
I remember the story of a woman in the ancient world who was killed because of her great learning.
Oh, yes. In the 4th century, Hypatia of Alexandria. She's recognised as one of the first female polymaths. She wrote treatises on geometry, algebra, astronomy, and invented scientific instruments as well. She gave lectures, and this upset a group of fanatics in the city who thought that women shouldn't speak in public. So they killed her. This is a very extreme example of the problems women faced when they tried to move out of their traditional domestic sphere.
After the fall of the Roman Empire, learning went into serious decline for both men and women, didn't it?
That's true, but literacy and scholarship managed to survive in the church. A good example of this is the German nun, Hildegard of Bingen. She lived from 1098 to 1179 and was a botanist, a philosopher, and a composer of religious music. Things changed rather in the 12th century when the first universities started to appear. Women were almost totally excluded, although the University of Bologna in Italy did allow women to study medicine, and one famous female Italian physician, Trotula da Ruggiero, produced texts on obstetrics and gynaecology.
So, if you look hard enough, you can find examples of women who managed to break through the gender stereotyping and participate in the scientific world. What held them back? Why haven't we heard of them?
Well, the patriarchal nature of society which prevailed for millennia meant that only a tiny proportion of women ever escaped from the confines of domesticity. The ideal woman was expected to be obedient and submissive. There was no role for them in public life. Thomas Aquinas, the great 13th century theologian and scholar, wrote that women were mentally incapable of holding positions of authority. Indeed, well into the 19th century, it was generally believed that women were ruled by their emotions and that their intellects were unable to deal with complex subjects like mathematics and science.
I suppose women in the past accepted that they were inferior to men, and the few who challenged the status quo were those who were educated enough and independently wealthy enough to contest this false assumption.
Very true. But by the end of the 19th century, the barriers were beginning to fall, but only after a long struggle. Nursing, medicine, the law, science, politics, all opened up to women. Also, we mustn't forget the importance of the women's right to vote movement, even though it took until 1932 before women in the UK voted on equal terms with men.
Well, despite all the gains, for many of us women in the 21st century, the fight still goes on. And sadly, for millions of women in the world, the fight hasn't even started yet. Now listen again. Hello to all our listeners. If someone asked you to produce a list of famous scientists and mathematicians, you might include the names of Archimedes, Isaac Newton, and Albert Einstein. All great men, certainly. But where are the great women on your list? Marie Curie, discoverer of radium and winner of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, might spring to mind. But can she be the only woman ever to have achieved fame in the world of science? Our guest today is Professor Richard James, an expert on the history of science, and he's going to shed some light on this question. So, Richard, where are the women scientists and mathematicians? Do they actually exist?
Yes, Anne, they've always existed. And the recent upsurge of interest in the apparent gender imbalance in most areas of endeavour throughout history has led academics to reappraise the accomplishments of women in the scientific sphere, despite the barriers and prejudices they faced.
Well, it's certainly good to know Marie Curie wasn't alone. How far back can we go in our search for female scientists?
A surprisingly long way. In the field of medicine, we have records of an Egyptian woman called Merit Ptah, who lived over 4,000 years ago and was described as chief physician. So Merit Ptah is the original female scientist. We also know of women scientists in ancient Greece. There was Aglionike, who predicted eclipses of the sun and moon, and Theano, who was a pupil and possibly also the wife of Pythagoras.
I remember the story of a woman in the ancient world who was killed because of her great learning.
Oh yes, in the 4th century, Hypatia of Alexandria. She's recognised as one of the first female polymaths. She wrote treatises on geometry, algebra, astronomy, and invented scientific instruments as well. She gave lectures, and this upset a group of fanatics in the city who thought that women shouldn't speak in public. So they killed her. This is a very extreme example of the problems women faced when they tried to move out of their traditional domestic sphere.
After the fall of the Roman Empire, learning went into serious decline for both men and women, didn't it?
That's true, but literacy and scholarship managed to survive in the church. A good example of this is the German nun, Hildegard of Bingen. She lived from 1098 to 1179 and was a botanist, a philosopher, and a composer of religious music. Things changed rather in the 12th century when the first universities started to appear. Women were almost totally excluded, although the University of Bologna in Italy did allow women to study medicine, and one famous female Italian physician, Trotula da Ruggiero, produced texts on obstetrics and gynecology.
So, if you look hard enough, you can find examples of women who managed to break through the gender stereotyping and participate in the scientific world. What held them back? Why haven't we heard of them?
Well, the patriarchal nature of society which prevailed for millennia meant that only a tiny proportion of women ever escaped from the confines of domesticity. The ideal woman was expected to be obedient and submissive. There was no role for them in public life. Thomas Aquinas, the great 13th century theologian and scholar, wrote that women were mentally incapable of holding positions of authority. Indeed, well into the 19th century, it was generally believed that women were ruled by their emotions and that their intellects were unable to deal with complex subjects like mathematics and science.
I suppose women in the past accepted that they were inferior to men. And the few who challenged the status quo were those who were educated enough and independently wealthy enough to contest this false assumption.
Very true. But by the end of the 19th century, the barriers were beginning to fall, but only after a long struggle. Nursing, medicine, the law, science, politics, all opened up to women. Also, we mustn't forget the importance of the women's right to vote movement, even though it took until 1932 before women in the UK voted on equal terms with men.
Well, despite all the gains, for many of us women in the 21st century, the fight still goes on. And sadly, for millions of women in the world, the fight hasn't even started yet. That is the end of Part 1, Section A of the listening test. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Listening Part 1, Section B. You will hear two social historians, Liz Newcomb and Paul Gillett, continuing the discussion about women in the world of science. For questions 6 to 10, choose the correct answer A, B or C. You will hear Section B twice. You have 1 minute to read the questions for Section B. Well, Paul, following on from the programme we just listened to, I think it's significant just how many women got involved in science through their husbands or other male relatives. I'm thinking in particular of the 18th century French woman, Marie-Anne Pauls, who married the chemist Antoine Lavoisier.
Yes, in those days science was more of a hobby than a paid profession. And scientists tended to be gentlemen with a private income and plenty of leisure time. They often set up laboratories or observatories in their own homes, so it was easy for a wife or daughter or sister to join in the fun.
That's exactly what happened to Marianne, who became her husband's assistant, helping him with all his experiments, through which, of course, he discovered oxygen.
Didn't she translate all the documents and letters he received from scientists in London because he didn't understand English?
That's right. She was very fluent and even translated an English textbook about the nature of heat on chemical reactions. Her knowledge of chemistry must have been considerable to do that.
Well, my favourite lady of science, an astronomer to be exact, is Caroline Herschel, sister of the much more famous William Herschel, who discovered the planet Uranus in 1781.
Oh, I'm a great fan of Caroline's too. But she didn't have an easy start in life, did she? She was born in Hanover in Germany in 1750, as far as I remember.
That's true. The youngest of eight children. Her father was a military musician who struggled with his health. Her mother was illiterate and thought that educating girls was a waste of time. And from a very early age, Caroline was an unpaid servant and got no further in her education than learning to read and write. Things got worse. When she was 10, she became very ill and lost the sight in one eye and actually stopped growing. Her prospects were not looking good.
Meanwhile, her elder brother, William, who was a brilliant musician, had got a job as an organist in England, and he asked Caroline to join him to help him set up a choir, which she did, after many arguments with her mother. She later became the leading soprano in William's musical performances. Then, great changes happened, as we know.
Yes! William was becoming increasingly interested in astronomy and started building his own high-performance telescopes. Caroline reluctantly put her singing career to one side to help William with his newfound hobby, and she became an accomplished astronomer in her own right. Then in March 1781, William, with his newest, most powerful telescope, discovered the planet Uranus. He was offered the post of Royal Astronomer by King George III, and his musical career, and Caroline's too, were quite forgotten.
Up to this point, Caroline was very much in William's shadow. She polished the telescope mirrors. She recorded her brother's observations of the night sky. At William's request, she began to sweep the stars with a telescope, moving through exact sections of the sky in search of new and interesting objects and keeping her own records. Before long, she discovered a new nebula, the first of many discoveries.
To continue the story, William built Caroline her own telescope, and with it, between 1786 and 1797, she discovered eight comets, more than anyone else has ever found. And she published her findings in scientific journals. In 1797, the king rewarded her with an annual salary of £50, £6,000 in today's money, and she became the first woman ever to be paid for her work in astronomy. Not bad for an uneducated little German girl.
Indeed not. She remained single all her life and was very jealous of William's wife when he finally married, but she adored William's son, John Herschel. She encouraged him to become an astronomer and continue the family tradition. When William died in 1822, Caroline was heartbroken and went back to Hanover.
In 1828, she was awarded a gold medal by the Royal Astronomical Society in London for her contributions to astronomy. But it wasn't until 1996 that another woman was awarded the gold medal.
She really was somebody special. She died in 1848, aged 97. She left behind a great body of work, and there's a crater on the moon named after her. But without Brother William, she might have remained in Hanover as her mother's unpaid servant.
You've forgotten her greatest honour. On her 266th birthday in 2016, she got a Google Doodle. Now, that's real fame for you.
Now listen again. Well, Paul, following on from the programme we just listened to, I think it's significant just how many women got involved in science through their husbands or other male relatives. I'm thinking in particular of the 18th century French woman, Marie-Anne Pauls, who married the chemist Antoine Lavoisier.
Yes, in those days science was more of a hobby than a paid profession, and scientists tended to be gentlemen with a private income and plenty of leisure time. They often set up laboratories or observatories in their own homes, so it was easy for a wife or daughter or sister to join in the fun.
That's exactly what happened to Marie-Anne, who became her husband's assistant, helping him with all his experiments, through which, of course, he discovered oxygen.
Didn't she translate all the documents and letters he received from scientists in London because he didn't understand English?
That's right. She was very fluent, and even translated an English textbook about the nature of heat on chemical reactions. Her knowledge of chemistry must have been considerable to do that.
Well, my favourite lady of science, an astronomer to be exact, is Caroline Herschel, sister of the much more famous William Herschel, who discovered the planet Uranus in 1781.
Oh, I'm a great fan of Caroline's too. But she didn't have an easy start in life, did she? She was born in Hanover in Germany in 1750, as far as I remember.
That's true. The youngest of eight children. Her father was a military musician who struggled with his health. Her mother was illiterate and thought that educating girls was a waste of time. And from a very early age, Caroline was an unpaid servant and got no further in her education than learning to read and write. Things got worse. When she was 10, she became very ill and lost the sight in one eye and actually stopped growing. Her prospects were not looking good.
Meanwhile, her elder brother, William, who was a brilliant musician, had got a job as an organist in England, and he asked Caroline to join him to help him set up a choir, which she did, after many arguments with her mother. She later became the leading soprano in William's musical performances. Then, great changes happened, as we know.
Yes! William was becoming increasingly interested in astronomy and started building his own high-performance telescopes. Caroline reluctantly put her singing career to one side to help William with his newfound hobby, and she became an accomplished astronomer in her own right. Then in March 1781, William, with his newest, most powerful telescope, discovered the planet Uranus. He was offered the post of Royal Astronomer by King George III, and his musical career, and Caroline's too, were quite forgotten.
Up to this point, Caroline was very much in William's shadow. She polished the telescope mirrors. She recorded her brother's observations of the night sky. At William's request, she began to sweep the stars with a telescope, moving through exact sections of the sky in search of new and interesting objects and keeping her own records. Before long, she discovered a new nebula, the first of many discoveries.
To continue the story, William built Caroline her own telescope, and with it, between 1786 and 1797, she discovered eight comets, more than anyone else has ever found, and she published her findings in scientific journals. In 1797, the king rewarded her with an annual salary of £50, £6,000 in today's money, and she became the first woman ever to be paid for her work in astronomy. Not bad for an uneducated little German girl.
Indeed not. She remained single all her life, and was very jealous of William's wife when he finally married, but she adored William's son, John Herschel. She encouraged him to become an astronomer and continue the family tradition. When William died in 1822, Caroline was heartbroken and went back to Hanover.
In 1828, she was awarded a gold medal by the Royal Astronomical Society in London for her contributions to astronomy. But it wasn't until 1996 that another woman was awarded the gold medal.
She really was somebody special. She died in 1848, aged 97. She left behind a great body of work, and there's a crater on the moon named after her. But without Brother William, she might have remained in Hanover as her mother's unpaid servant.
You've forgotten her greatest honour. On her 266th birthday in 2016, she got a Google Doodle. Now, that's real fame for you.
That is the end of Part 1, Section B of the listening test. Now turn to Part 2. Listening Part 2. Listen to three conversations, and for questions 11 to 20, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C. You will hear each conversation twice. You have 2 minutes to read the questions for Part 2. Conversation 1. Hi, Alex. How was Mexico?
Fantastic. Stephanie wants us to go back again next year. The hotel was great. Beautiful beach. How was Athens? Did you get to see the Acropolis?
We did. It was stunning. David was blown away by it. But what I was really taken by was something very unexpected.
What was that?
Well, on our first evening in Athens, we wandered up to the Acropolis. We wanted to watch the sunset from the Areopagus Rock, where St. Paul preached to the Athenians. We went up the back way, and we came across a colony of stray cats.
That's not unusual. I know you're a cat lover like me, but...
No, this was different. Every one of these cats was eating a pile of cat food, and there were people around feeding them. These cats were all street cats, but they looked so sleek and well-fed, so healthy and in really good condition. We got talking to a young student, and she told us that there's a charity in Athens called Nine Lives Greece, and they look after the feral cats. They catch them, neuter them, feed them at feeding stations around Athens, take them to the vet, and find homes for them.
What a coincidence! At the hotel in Mexico, in the garden, there was a little area called the Cats Cafe, with shelters for the cats, and 2 meals a day provided by the hotel management. You're discouraged from feeding them because they'll pester you at mealtimes if you do. But you can stroke them and play with them and give money too, which of course we did. Stephanie wanted to bring one back to England, a black kitten with white paws. But it was just too difficult. Too much bureaucracy. But I've got some lovely pictures of this kitten. Now, where's my phone?
I've got cat pics too. Look at this lovely ginger one. He's on the Nine Lives Greece website and in their charity calendar too. His name's Leo. Now listen again. Hi, Alex. How was Mexico?
Fantastic. Stephanie wants us to go back again next year. The hotel was great. Beautiful beach. How was Athens? Did you get to see the Acropolis?
We did. It was stunning. David was blown away by it. But what I was really taken by was something very unexpected.
What was that?
Well, on our first evening in Athens, we wandered up to the Acropolis. We wanted to watch the sunset from the Areopagus Rock, where St. Paul preached to the Athenians. We went up the back way, and we came across a colony of stray cats.
That's not unusual. I know you're a cat lover like me, but...
No, this was different. Every one of these cats was eating a pile of cat food, and there were people around feeding them. These cats were all street cats, but they looked so sleek and well-fed, so healthy and in really good condition. We got talking to a young student, and she told us that there's a charity in Athens called Nine Lives Greece, and they look after the feral cats. They catch them, neuter them, feed them at feeding stations around Athens, take them to the vet, and find homes for them.
What a coincidence! At the hotel in Mexico, in the garden, there was a little area called the Cats Cafe, with shelters for the cats, and two meals a day provided by the hotel management. You're discouraged from feeding them because they'll pester you at mealtimes if you do. But you can stroke them and play with them and give money too, which of course we did. Stephanie wanted to bring one back to England, a black kitten with white paws. But it was just too difficult. Too much bureaucracy. But I've got some lovely pictures of this kitten. Now, where's my phone?
I've got cat pics too. Look at this lovely ginger one. He's on the Nine Lives Greece website and in their charity calendar too. His name's Leo. Conversation 2. Oh, Harry, have you got a few minutes?
Sure, Andrea. What's the problem?
Well, it's silly, really. But I've got a bet with my brother, Oliver, about whether we'll have a white Christmas this year. I say no, and he says yes. If I win, he's going to teach me to drive, and if he wins, I've promised to wash his football kit for the whole of January. You're a meteorologist. Do you think we'll have snow at Christmas this year?
To be honest, long-range weather forecasting is very difficult despite all the modern technology we use. It's very hard to predict. It depends on so many things. Where you live, for example. If you're up in the north of Scotland, you're much more likely to get a white Christmas than if you live in the south of England, where it's much milder. We're in the middle of the country, so it could go either way.
There are lots of myths about the weather. Is there any truth in them? Things like, if there are lots of berries on the trees in the autumn, then a hard winter will follow.
I've a couple more. A cold November, a warm Christmas. Do you know that one? People also think that if the winter migrant birds fly to the UK from Russia early in October rather than later in October, that means a cold winter. There's no hard scientific evidence to support these beliefs, but who can say? People look at a field of cows all lying down and say that means it's going to rain. And sometimes they're right.
Well, what exactly are the chances of a white Christmas here where we live?
Probably about 25% if we look at the statistics, but even if the whole country is covered in snow on Christmas Day, Oliver may not win his bet.
How come?
Many people bet money on a white Christmas, so rules have been drawn up. To have an official white Christmas, fresh snow has to fall within the 24 hours of December the 25th. So snow that fell before Christmas Day and is still lying on the ground doesn't count. The last widespread white Christmas in the UK was in 2010, so it's quite an infrequent event. And even somewhere like New York, where it's bitterly cold in December, has only had a white Christmas two or three times in the last 20 years.
Thanks, Harry. I'm going to stop worrying about washing that football kit and start saving up for a car. Now listen again. Oh, Harry, have you got a few minutes?
Sure, Andrea. What's the problem?
Well, it's silly, really. But I've got a bet with my brother, Oliver, about whether we'll have a white Christmas this year. I say no, and he says yes. If I win, he's going to teach me to drive, and if he wins, I've promised to wash his football kit for the whole of January. You're a meteorologist. Do you think we'll have snow at Christmas this year?
To be honest, long-range weather forecasting is very difficult despite all the modern technology we use. It's very hard to predict. It depends on so many things. Where you live, for example. If you're up in the north of Scotland, you're much more likely to get a white Christmas than if you live in the south of England, where it's much milder. We're in the middle of the country, so it could go either way.
There are lots of myths about the weather. Is there any truth in them? Things like, if there are lots of berries on the trees in the autumn, then a hard winter will follow.
I have a couple more. A cold November, a warm Christmas. Do you know that one? People also think that if the winter migrant birds fly to the UK from Russia early in October rather than later in October, that means a cold winter. There's no hard scientific evidence to support these beliefs, but who can say? People look at a field of cows all lying down and say that means it's going to rain. And sometimes they're right.
Well, what exactly are the chances of a white Christmas here where we live?
Probably about 25% if we look at the statistics, but even if the whole country is covered in snow on Christmas Day, Oliver may not win his bet.
How come?
Many people bet money on a white Christmas, so rules have been drawn up. To have an official white Christmas, fresh snow has to fall within the 24 hours of December the 25th. So snow that fell before Christmas Day and is still lying on the ground doesn't count. The last widespread white Christmas in the UK was in 2010, so it's quite an infrequent event. And even somewhere like New York, where it's bitterly cold in December, has only had a white Christmas two or three times in the last 20 years.
Thanks, Harry. I'm going to stop worrying about washing that football kit and start saving up for a car. Conversation 3. Hi, Jamie. I want to talk to you about Edinburgh. Simon and I are going there next month. You were at Edinburgh University, so you know the city very well, don't you? What would you recommend?
It's a fantastic place. It's built on seven hills, so there are fantastic views of the city and the Firth of Forth, which is the name of the estuary into the sea. There are three bridges stretching across the water to the other side. The oldest is the Forth Railway Bridge, an amazing example of 19th century engineering and still going strong. Then there's the Forth Road Bridge, a suspension bridge built in the late 1950s and now used by public transport, cyclists and walkers. And the brand new third bridge, the Queen's Ferry Bridge, which was opened by the Queen in the summer of 2017 and is now the main crossing point for cars.
Sounds interesting. We're both keen on history, so where should we start our tour?
I suggest you start at Edinburgh Castle. It's one of the most historic places in the city. Every day at 1 o'clock precisely, a gun is fired from the castle walls so all the ships out at sea can set their maritime clocks to the exact time. From the castle, you can walk along the Royal Mile, a long, narrow street running down to Holyrood Palace, which is the Queen's official residence in Scotland. Oh, and if you're brave enough, you can join one of the evening ghost tours and explore some of the mysterious alleyways of the city.
No, I think we're both a bit too nervous for that. But I like the sound of Holyrood Palace. Is it open to the public?
not when the Queen is in residence, but it's open daily at any other time. It's associated with Mary, Queen of Scots, and you can see her private rooms and some of her possessions too.
That sounds good. I'm a great art lover too, so I'll certainly want to go to the National Gallery of Scotland.
Well worth a visit. You can spend hours in there, but you can't come to Edinburgh without visiting the New Town.
I'm not very interested in modern architecture. I'll give the New Town a miss.
Let me explain. The New Town was built in the 18th century, so it's more than 200 years old. It's full of elegant classical townhouses and is considered to be a model of town planning. It's really upmarket, and all the best people in Edinburgh live there.
You've convinced me. We'll have a stroll round the New Town. There's one place I really do want to visit above everything else. It's the cafe where J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter.
Yeah, the birthplace of Harry Potter has become one of the most popular attractions in the city. It's called the Elephant House Cafe, and it's not far from the castle. Harry Potter fans from all over the world make a beeline for it, so it gets very crowded.
Thanks, Jamie. I think we'll have a great time in Edinburgh. Now listen again. Hi, Jamie. I want to talk to you about Edinburgh. Simon and I are going there next month. You were at Edinburgh University, so you know the city very well, don't you? What would you recommend?
It's a fantastic place. It's built on seven hills, so there are fantastic views of the city and the Firth of Forth, which is the name of the estuary into the sea. There are three bridges stretching across the water to the other side. The oldest is the Forth Railway Bridge, an amazing example of 19th century engineering and still going strong. Then there's the Forth Road Bridge, a suspension bridge built in the late 1950s, and now used by public transport, cyclists and walkers, and the brand new third bridge, the Queen's Ferry Bridge, which was opened by the Queen in the summer of 2017 and is now the main crossing point for cars.
Sounds interesting. We're both keen on history, so where should we start our tour?
I suggest you start at Edinburgh Castle. It's one of the most historic places in the city. Every day at 1 o'clock precisely, a gun is fired from the castle walls so all the ships out at sea can set their maritime clocks to the exact time. From the castle, you can walk along the Royal Mile, a long, narrow street running down to Holyrood Palace, which is the Queen's official residence in Scotland. Oh, and if you're brave enough, you can join one of the evening ghost tours and explore some of the mysterious alleyways of the city.
No, I think we're both a bit too nervous for that. But I like the sound of Holyrood Palace. Is it open to the public?
Not when the Queen is in residence, but it's open daily at any other time. It's associated with Mary, Queen of Scots, and you can see her private rooms and some of her possessions too.
That sounds good. I'm a great art lover too, so I'll certainly want to go to the National Gallery of Scotland.
Well worth a visit. You can spend hours in there, but you can't come to Edinburgh without visiting the New Town.
I'm not very interested in modern architecture. I'll give the New Town a miss.
Let me explain. The New Town was built in the 18th century, so it's more than 200 years old. It's full of elegant classical townhouses and is considered to be a model of town planning. It's really upmarket, and all the best people in Edinburgh live there.
You've convinced me. We'll have a stroll round the New Town. There's one place I really do want to visit above everything else. It's the cafe where J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter.
Yeah, the birthplace of Harry Potter has become one of the most popular attractions in the city. It's called the Elephant House Cafe, and it's not far from the castle. Harry Potter fans from all over the world make a beeline for it, so it gets very crowded.
Thanks, Jamie. I think we'll have a great time in Edinburgh. That is the end of the listening test.